Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and today I'm going to continue where I left off last week, continuing with the testament of the Irish political prisoner, hunger striker, Bobby Sands, and his testament, One Day in My Life, which I began last week about this testament of his experience in just, one of the many, many days he spent. You know, he was in jail for years in a British jail in Northern Ireland. And he was 27 years old. Bobby Sands was 27 years old and had been on hunger strike for 66 days when he died on May 5th, 1981. And the young IRA volunteer was world famous by the time of his death, having spent the last 9 years of his short life in prison, and had been elected while still a prisoner to the British Parliament. The hunger strike was aimed at rebutting the British government's attempts to criminalize the struggle for Irish freedom by changing Sands and his fellow cellmates' status from political to criminal. While behind bars, Sands secretly wrote on toilet paper and cigarette papers with a refill of a cheap pen that he kept hidden inside his body. These writings were then smuggled out of the prison. With dry humor, they chart a man's attempt to preserve his identity against appalling beatings, unimaginable filth, freezing cold, and numbing boredom. In poetry and prose, he vividly evokes the enclosed hell of Longkesh prison, the harassment, and the humiliating invasive searches. And his writings from prison stand as a testament to the political prisoners' courage and their indomitable struggle for recognition and freedom. So this is why I'm reading this. It's heavy stuff. Like a day in my life is not a easy thing to read. That is not an easy piece of writing to read, but I still think it's important. This is also in solidarity with Hadar Adnan, you know, the Palestinian man who died in an Israeli prison earlier this month, on the 2nd of May, 2023, after 85 days on hunger strike. It really is in solidarity with him and other Palestinians who have stood up to the occupation of their land, and who refuse to be criminalized, refuse to be denigrated, refuse to be beaten or broken down. And it's really in solidarity with them that I'm reading this right now, that I'm reading this this piece by Bobby Sands, who, and of course the Irish freedom struggle and the Palestinian freedom struggle have been joined, you know, for a long time. There's been a lot of solidarity between them. Those resisting British occupation in Northern Ireland and those resisting Israeli occupation in Palestine. You know, there's been a long history of solidarity there going back many decades. And certainly Bobby Sands himself, you know, would definitely want there to be recognition of the Palestinian struggle and for his writings to reinforce that struggle, you know, like for there to be solidarity there. So that's why I'm going to continue doing this today. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR as I continue reading from Bobby Sands, A Day in My Life. I set my cold tea on the floor and took the wee parcel out of my mouth. As a relief, the wee parcel was wet and I dried it at the end of my towel. I couldn't examine it in the darkness. I would do that later. I wrapped the three blankets around me and put my wee parcel in the fold of the blanket that was wrapped around my waist. The doors were opening and slamming shut as the cold tea was being handed into the cells. The drone of the cleaning machine continued unabated, and they'd probably leave it on for a few hours to try to drive us insane. I wondered, had anything else occurred while I was away? I threw the cold tea out the window and took a quick look into the corners where the rubbish lay, just in case an adventurous rat had decided to have a look around while I was out. It wouldn't have been the first time that had happened to me. It even happened during the night on one occasion. I sat down on the mattress and began to eat my cold food, reflecting on the highlight of my month, my visit. I finished off my cold, meager tea and set the plastic dishes on the floor. Back to my fight for survival, I thought, feeling the cold and rising to resume where I'd left off on my endless walk to nowhere in the darkness. I checked that my little parcel was secure and reveled in the self-esteem of success. I couldn't figure out why C and D didn't try to forcibly bend me over when I arrived back to carry out another humiliating body search. They had seemed somewhat eager to get me back to my cell again. The floor was very cold, so I stopped to spread the blanket on it to enable me to continue my endless pacing. The snow still lay on the ground outside and began to fall again slowly, little flakes floating in through the open window. The cleaning machine, deliberately left on, droned in the background. I tried to overcome the harassing sound with thought. I would have liked to tell Sean the good news of the victory, but he wouldn't hear me over the continuous noise. I began to think about the wee bits of skill that I had heard on my visit to tell the boys later on. It wouldn't be long until supper time, for the tea had been served very late. But that wouldn't be anything to look forward to either. Probably a mug of lukewarm tea and a round of bread and margarine. All it really meant was that it wouldn't be long until lockup when the screws would go home for the night and no more cell doors would open until tomorrow morning. I gazed out the window thinking that I could always watch the rats running up and down the yard when it got really quiet later on. I wouldn't be able to get into my bed on the ground too early. The cold wouldn't allow me to sleep. I was tired. In fact, I was exhausted. But the day was not over yet by any means. I wondered how the boys on the boards were. Perhaps someone in another block or wing may have come back from the boards today and could tell if anything else had occurred. The shouting to the other wings and blocks would start when things settled down later, when the screws went home. I heard the slam of the cell door facing me. It had been barely audible. They were probably collecting the dishes. No use shouting at the door with a drone, as no one would hear it. My cell door opened and the light was turned on. The orderly lifted the dishes and the door slammed shut again. I didn't see the screws as the illumination of the cell left me temporarily blinded. The sudden change from darkness to light cut at my eyes. My stinking surroundings came screaming up in me once again. The white squares of discarded stale bread added a new feature to the rubbish piles in the corners. I noticed the marks in the sides of the sliced bread and lifted one from the rubbish. It was blue molded. Thank God I hadn't eaten the bread, I thought, examining the rest of the slices to find that they were the same. I knew immediately what had happened, why C&D didn't forcibly bend me over, and why they were so eager to get me back into my cell, to eat my tea in the dark. I had been too busy thinking of my mouth full of contraband to scrutinize the bread on my plate on my way back to the cell. The cleaning machine droned and whined in the background. The cell light was very bright, and already my eyes were hurting. I felt the dreaded early morning tinges of a migraine headache building up inside the back of my head. I kept pacing the floor, taking deep breaths of air at the window to try and clear the stuffy, wheezy sickliness that was also beginning to bother me. The machine became more annoying. The temperature was falling outside, and the coating of frost on the wire grew thicker. I took out my little parcel and had a peek at it. It was intact. I could see the contents through the stretch-and-seal plastic wrapping, the wee note, the cigarette papers, and the brown tobacco. I couldn't open it up now, so I put it back again in the fold of my blanket for later. Being the possessor of a wee note from my sister, cigarette papers, and a quarter ounce of tobacco made me feel like a king. What would it be like if they were to open the door now and throw me out to freedom? I wouldn't be able to cope with it. Dear God, I could hardly bear up to a visit. I just couldn't imagine what state I would be in if I were to be released from this torture. I knew how to appreciate small, seemingly unimportant things now that one time or another I would have taken for granted, or probably not even noticed. When was the last time I received a decent warm meal? Funny how one can adapt to things, especially when you're starving, I thought. Remembering the times during the summer when the orderlies and screws had dropped maggots into our dinners and all we could do was search for them and remove them, then eat our dinners as if nothing had happened. It was either that or starve. The drone from the cleaning machine suddenly stopped and a terrible, unnatural silence fell once again. I heard the footsteps of the screw who had turned off the machine walking back along the wing. I put my eye to the little spy hole. It was A. He walked on past towards the little office. I heard the sound of the television going, but was unable to make out any words. The orderlies were shouting and carrying on between themselves. I heard C shouting, "Right!" and the carry-on of the shouting orderlies died immediately to be replaced by the rattle of the tea trolley. "Tea on the air," some of the lads shouted in Gaelic. The cell doors began to open and close. They passed by my cell, going down the other side of the wing. One of the lads, a few cells down, was singing to himself, and a bit of life came back into the wing. The tea trolley finally arrived at my door. The usual hated faces were standing there when the cell door opened. The orderly handed me a mug of tea and a slice of bread doubled in two. I caught D sniggering as he saw me glancing at the bread for any signs of blue mold. It was all right. The door slammed and I retreated to the mattress, detecting an unnatural warmth and seeing the steam rising from the plastic mug. It was hot. I could hardly believe it. I sat down and somewhat sheepishly tasted it. It was weak as water. In fact, it was simply colored hot water, but I decided to brave it. Anything hot was a godsend on a night like this, I thought, even hot water. I ate the slice of bread and sipped the warm weak tea. It won't be long until lockup, I thought, relishing the thought of the parcel and the smoke. My mother and father and sister would be at home now, and most likely they wouldn't be feeling the best. They would have had a terrible hard day, and having seen my appearance, they would do nothing else but worry. I thought of the families who had two or three sons inside, and those with sons on the blanket protest, or those with daughters in the protest in Armagh. It must have been really hard on those families. There was heartbreak everywhere. That's all that ever came out of the stinking hellholes. Grief and heartbreak. I couldn't drink any more of the weak tea. It was growing cooler and becoming a bit sickening. I rose and threw it out the window on the snow and watched the puff of steam rise as it buried itself. Setting the cup on the floor, I returned to my pacing as the doors began to open and close. "Cups off the air," came the cry. My feet were getting colder. I stamped them on the blanket on the floor. The cold was going to be very intense tonight, all right. The singer down the wing began to sing a new song to himself. There was nothing to sing about, but one had to overcome the terrible monotony some way or other. I was getting bored myself, but it was more impatience than anything else, as my wee parcel was burning a hole in my blanket, so to speak. My cell door opened and the cup was removed. I didn't even bother to look around. The door slammed and the procession of screws and orderlies proceeded towards the end of the wing. I sat down on the mattress once again to rest. There were 8 of the boys on the other side of the wing who smoked, plus 9 on this side, but 3 were away to the boards, so that left 14 smokers, including myself. I would be able to arrange a cigarette for everyone tonight, with perhaps a bit to spare. It would mean shooting a line under the bottom of the best door across the wing, to the cells opposite to get the cigarettes over to the other lads. The boys on the other side of the wing couldn't swing or pass things out their windows because they were blocked up. But they had engineered little holes in the walls where the pipes ran through, which would enable them to pass the cigarettes up and down the line, as well as a light. A light for the cigarettes would be engineered by one of the lads using a piece of glass, a small flint, and a bit of fluffy wool. A wick would be made and lit, allowing the glowing material to be passed carefully from one cell to the next, until everyone got a light. Getting a line across would be tricky and dangerous. It always was. The screws knew we did it, and they were always on the prowl, lurking and tiptoeing around the wing at night. B would be on tonight, on night guard, which meant we would have to be extra careful. I checked to see if the long line I had plaited earlier was still there. It was all right. Sean knocked on the wall. "Down to the pipe," I said, getting down to the corner on top of my mattress with my head right to the wall where the pipes ran through. There wasn't a great deal of heat coming through the pipes. What there was went streaming out the open window into the cold, dark night. "Well, Bobby," came Sean's inquiring voice through the small hole in the wall. "Go my case, Sean," I said in delight. "I made it back with the other." He knew what I meant. "Matthew," he said. And I began to tell him about my visit and related the happenings with the searches and all the rest. I sensed the excitement building up in Sean's voice as I told him about all the happenings, the great turnout for the parade, and the massive offensive in the war effort. In general, things were going better than ever before. The British government's attempts to criminalize the Republican movement had failed miserably, and now everyone realized just exactly what the motives behind the tortures in the H blocks were aimed at. I continued my conversation with Sean for some time, until I began to feel cramped, lying in my unnatural position by the pipes and wall. So I decided to go back to pacing the floor once again. My feet were numb with the cold, and Sean understood. He was in much the same condition. I told him that I'd call him later, and we both left our corners to resume where we left off in our endless pacing. The screws began to lock grills and doors in preparation for the nearing lockup. The orderlies had left the wing for their dormitories, which were 2 large rooms adjoining the wings, especially opened and equipped with such luxuries as television, radio, and record player, and a host of other things. The payment for their dirty work that they did exceedingly well. Some orderlies didn't bother us, but they were very few and hard to find. A, C, and D were hovering at the top of the wing, talking and joking, and waiting for the call to lock up. It wouldn't be too far away, I thought. Perhaps 15 minutes? There were 2 head counts to be done yet. One by the leaving screws, A, and company, and the other by the night guard who would be arriving shortly. The night guard would only consist of four screws. Sometimes they watched television, played cards, and drank themselves into a stupor and wouldn't bother us. But most times there was trouble, and more so if there was someone like B on, and B was on tonight. I was bored pacing up and down, so I decided to sit down and risk opening my wee parcel. The chances of a cell search now were slender, but the danger was always there, so one had to be very careful. It would be a terrible thing to get caught after what we had gone through today, but I was impatient to get reading my wee note. So I took out my little treasured parcel and began peeling the glossy stretch and seal off it until I had the note. Before I began to read my sister's letter, I wrapped the loose stretch and seal back around the rest of the contents, just in case. I sat quietly for 2 or 3 minutes, taking in every word of her neat handwriting. When I had finished, I reread it. It was good to hear from her again. It seemed an eternity since I had seen her, but she seemed to be doing all right, more worried about me than anything else, and inquiring about the other lads that she knew. I would have to try and get a wee note to her as soon as I could. We had one miserly pencil and pen refill that was constantly in use around the wing, going from one cell to the next, back and forth from one side of the wing to the other, eating up sheets of bog roll, toilet paper, for the wee smuggled notes to worried wives, mothers and girlfriends, for the letters to the newspapers, and the quickly scribbled notes to the H-Block Information Bureau, telling of the beatings and horrors that took place every single day. I would have to wait my turn for the pen or pencil. I tore my sister's wee note up into shreds and threw it out the open window, watching it blow away across the snow-covered yard until it disappeared along with the falling snow. A and company were still at the top of the wing at the grills. I could hear the jingling of the keys and the occasional murmuring voice. I decided to take another chance and open the parcel once again to roll the cigarettes and have them ready for the lads in the line to be shot across the wing later. I unwrapped the covering again and took out the small lump of tobacco that was very fresh and squashed for convenience sake. I began to shred it and loosen it up to enable me to roll the cigarettes. The small lump grew into a small stringy pile. The aroma of the tobacco was a pleasant change from the evil stench that usually hung in the air of my cell. I stripped the cigarette papers that clung to each other into a pile until I had enough of the requirements and a few left over. When I had everything ready, I commenced my task of rolling them, my ears alert for the slightest telltale sound of a footstep or key, while telling myself all the time that it wouldn't be long until I was lying on the mattress smoking one of the cigarettes that I was making now. 5 completed. I began the 6th, thinking of how much one lousy cigarette meant, and how it could lift morale, even of the lads who didn't smoke. Somehow or other, everybody realized and took satisfaction from the fact that somebody or other had gotten one over on the bastards like A and C, and that meant a great deal. I lifted another cigarette paper and began the 7th cigarette, bears in the air. I heard the jingle of a key and whipped the blanket over the contraband as the lock on my door rattled and the door flew open. I tried to act normally in my panic, shock flooding my entire body. A looked into the cell. 1, he said as C slammed the door shut again. Head count on the air, I yelled, terror clinging to my voice. 2, I heard A say as Sean's door slammed. 4, 6, 8, as they continued down the wing. A cold wave swept my body. That was close, I thought, as I looked at the blanket and covered the tobacco in cigarettes. One cigarette was half visible, but they never saw it. I sat glued to my mattress as the head count continued. 20, 22, 24, 26, A counted. Bears off the air, one of the lads shouted, signaling the all clear as the final number tallied and A, C, and D left the wing, slamming the office door shut as they departed. I recovered my composure and contraband and went back to my rolling. I should have everything finished before the next and last head counted, I thought. Besides, we'd hear B long before he'd ever reached the wing, as he would most certainly be drunk. I worked on until I had completed all the cigarettes, whereupon I divided them into 2 parcels. One contained the cigarettes for the lads on the other side, and the other one contained the cigarette for each of the boys down this side. I got the long, thin line that I had plaited earlier and tied both parcels to it, and attached a bit of stale, blue, molded bread to the end of it, and to wait it before rapping on the wall for Sean. "Hello," he shouted. "Put your hand out." I said, and began swinging the line to him. When he caught hold of it, I explained the contents of the parcels, telling him to send the line and the parcel down the wing to the man who would be doing the shot to the other side so that he could get things ready. Sean knocked on the cell wall next to him and began to get things boxed off with the lads. I put my own cigarette, plus an extra one for myself and Sean, under the pillow. The rattle of grills and keys sounded, then footsteps followed by a mouthful of obscenities as B announced his arrival. The footsteps came tramping down the wing, and the final head count began on the other side of the wing to another barrage of slamming doors. They worked their way around the doors, and then my door opened. B peered in. He was barely able to stand, let alone count. He half stumbled away, and the door shut again. Bears off the air. The all clear came. No one had even bothered to announce their arrival. It was obvious enough. A hush fell upon the wing, and one of the men down the wing called out, "Right, lads, we'll say the rosary now. Who's going to say the first mystery?" "I will," someone shouted. "And the second?" "I will," said Sean. And three other lads volunteered to say the three remaining decades. "It's the sorrowful mysteries tonight," the same voice said, blessing himself and saying the opening prayers himself. The rosary continued, being answered by the boys out of the grills. Halfway through the third mystery, a screw decided to bang the grills with his baton. The rosary carried on as usual, and the screw got fed up and departed. When the rosary ended, the wing was a flurry of activity and buzzing with conversation. The boys down the wing decided to do the line across the wing before B came prowling or some other screw. "Hey, Bobby, will you keep watch?" one of the boys shouted. "Okay, go ahead," I shouted back, going to my little spy hole at the door. Shooting the line across would be a tricky operation. "Hey, Sean, can you see out your door?" the same voice asked. "No way," Sean answered. "I can," one of the lads at the bottom said. "Can you see Gerard's door?" "No problem," came the reply. "Matthew," said the man, who was about to do the shot. "You can guide us." "You there, Bobby?" someone asked, double-checking. If the line was caught, it would be a catastrophe. "I'm here," I said, not daring to move my eye from the little hole. The long line would be secured to a button and flicked along the ground under the door and across the corridor. The man on the other side would search for it outside his door using a strip of paper. When he detected it, he would slide the paper underneath and pull it under his door. Then the ferrying of notes, cigarettes, or whatever to and fro began. The cigarettes would be tied onto the line and like a long train dragged across. "You ready, Gerard?" the shooter asked. "Go ahead, Pat," came the reply. There was a sharp crack and the scrape of the button sliding across the floor. "Can you see it, Brian?" the shooter asked the man, guiding him down the wing a bit. "Too far to the left," he said. "Shoot it again." The line was drawn in, and the sharp crack sounded again as the button slid across the corridor. The wing was deadly silent, every ear listening for the slightest telltale sound. "What's that like, Brian?" "Too short," came the tense reply. The line was drawn in once again. The third shot was too hard and bounced off the door and had to be tried again. The fourth sharp crack sounded. "How's that?" came the nervous voice of the shooter. The whole wing listened in anticipation. "Leave it where it is," came the excited reply. "Put your piece of paper out, Gerard," the spotter directed. The paper rustles and the paper rustled as it slid out underneath. "Move it to the left," he directed again. "Another few inches. That's it. Leave it there. Now push it out as far as you can." "No good. Try again." My eye was beginning to hurt being pressed against the little hole. The silence remained. No one dared to speak except the team at work. The paper rustled again. "Push it on out, Gerard. Nice and gently. That's it. Easy, easy. Matthew. Gerard." It's like the button's sitting on top of the paper. "Pull it back in to you slowly. Go ahead. Go ahead. Take it easy." "I've got it," came the successful disclosure. "All right up there, Bobby?" "Okay, I think so anyway, Pat." "Pull the line on over to you, Gerard," Pat said, "but don't tug on it too hard." The cigarette slid out underneath the shooter's door and across the corridor. "Take it easy," the spotter said, "and they'll stick underneath the door." All the cigarettes got under Gerard's door except the last one, just got entangled in the line. Don't pull it, Brian said. Flick the line a little. That's it. Sorting itself out. Try it now. I caught a glimpse of a moving shadow and the squeak of a boot. Bear in the air, I yelled. And he shot past my line of vision. Pull on it, Gerard, Brian yelled. There was a scuffling noise as the screw tried to grab the line. Then silence followed by the retreating footsteps of the screw. I caught a glimpse of his face as he passed by. He was a stranger. All right, Gerard, Pat asked. Okay, Pat, I got in all the blows, but the screw got the button. At least the cigarettes were okay. The loss of the button wasn't a catastrophe, but a loss all the same in these conditions. Okay, lads, slop it out now, Yossi said. We began to filter the reeking urine out the doors. If we didn't do it, then the screws would do it for us the first thing in the morning. It's not a pleasant thing to be awakened by the splashing contents of a filthy pool of urine. There wasn't too much left in the pose due to the slop out earlier on. I worked at the foot of the door trying to get it out. When I'd finished, I retreated to the mattress to rest. I was completely out of breath and panting. A good indication of just how bad my state of physical health was in, I thought, when I became exhausted that easily. I sat back awaiting the arrival of the glowing wick, which would provide me with a light. Lucky enough with the blows, I thought. The screw had arrived a few minutes earlier. He would have caught the whole lot. Sean knocked on the wall. Right, Bobby, here's the effort. I knew what he meant and put my hand out the window to catch the swinging line with the glowing, improvised wick dangling at the end of it. I took it in and lit my cigarette. Here you are, Sean, I called. Go ahead, he answered as I swung the line back to him. He knocked on the other wall to pass it down the line as I lay down to smoke the cigarette. It was soothing and a relief to lie and enjoy something without the worry of the door bursting open. The keys for the doors were not kept in the H-blocks, but elsewhere. The boys in the other wing would see the arrival of any strange screws-bearing keys and raise the alarm. Bears in the yard, came the warning. But there was no real need or concern unless you were in the process of swinging something to another cell. The screws were down at the bottom of the yard, hurling abuse at the lads further down. I finished off my cigarette, then got up to the window to see who they were. They came swaggering up the yard, B, who was shouting and slobbering his head off. There were two others along with him who were endeavoring to add their 4 pence worth of abuse. They passed on in the direction of the other wing. The OC called for everyone's attention, and silence fell immediately. As he asked, did anyone see or make out what happened during the earlier incidents concerning the slop-out and Pee-wee O'Donnell? I told him what I had heard and seen out the door. Several others were able to put more to it. He then asked what were the injuries received during the early morning wing shift. The bloody accounts of damage were given out the doors. Okay, he said, when everyone had finished. Nothing else? That was all the business concluded and noted for the information center outside.
The monsters came just the other day. Rise up.
Any scale, Bobby? Some of the lads asked, and for about 5 minutes I related all I had heard. I think that's the heap, lads, I said when I was certain that I'd yelled it all out. Yahoos and cheers followed. Then the conversations at the windows, pipes, and doors resumed, discussing, debating, and speculating on every little piece of news. The scale was good, and that meant a terrible lot. Reports were coming across the far yard to the lads whose windows were blocked up from the other wing, about what had taken place that day in the other two wings of the block. One man from each wing was away to the boards. One man was beaten up very badly. 6 cells hosed down, and the daily horror reports kept coming in. The stench from the outside corridor was sickening. I rose and moved to the window to try to get some air. The snow glistened in the brilliance of the massive lights, and the noise of shouting and singing came on the breeze from the other blanket blocks. Hundreds of naked, physically wrecked men had come alive. It was bitter cold now. I wrapped all the blankets around me and put the towel around my head like a scarf once more. The boys in the other blocks were shouting to each other, passing messages back and forth, and the horror reports began to be shouted from the other wings. Several men severely beaten during a wing shift, 2 men taken to the boards, 3 men scalded in another wing, and 2 sent to the boards having been caught with tobacco coming back from visits. 1 man returned from the boards had been beaten up and forcibly bathed while he was there. 7 men beaten up and forcibly bathed on the boards. Pee Wee O'Donnell taken to the hospital and the others badly bruised. "You hear that, Sean?" I said. "I heard it, Bobby," he answered. The horror reports continued. 44 men beaten, bathed, and had their heads shaved in another wing. 2 men in the hospital. 2 more were missing, probably on the boards. The reports in Gaelic continued. H5 began to tell H3 that several men were hurt during a slop-out done by the screws, and 1 man was taken to the boards. H3 received 6 new blanket men sentenced the day before. The shouting continued. The distance to each block was quite a bit, but the sound carried and echoed and carried in the night across the snow over the gray timbers and barbed wire. Several messages had to be repeated before they were understood, and several times words had to be spelled out one letter at a time. But with a bit of perseverance and patience, the communication system worked. But with the blocking up of the windows, that would finish also. "Lights out!" one of the boys shouted from the other side of the wing. The screws were extinguishing the lights. They'd most likely be around in the middle of the night to put them on again. Not that we'd get much sleep in the cold anyway, I thought as the screw put out my light out. I knocked on the wall for Sean. "Hello," he said. "Get the effort up on the line," I said. "Matthew," he replied, and called up the line for the improvised wick. "Are you listening, Sean?" I asked and added. I'll swing you in a blow. Then I'm sending the line back, okay? Matthew, he replied once again. The line reached Sean's cell, and he swung it to me, whereupon I lit a second cigarette, tied on the one for him, and swung it back to him again. Okay, comrade? Sound, he replied. I sat down once again. I kept thinking that the chances I'd taken had been worth it. The smoke streamed up in the dim light and out the windows, and for another few minutes, the stench was blotted out by the aroma of tobacco. It was very cold. I decided to go back to my pacing when I'd finished my cigarette. Poor Pee-wee, I thought, lying in the prison hospital or maybe even in Musgrave. The rest of the lads on the boards would be lying battered and sore. I wasn't feeling the best myself. My earlier wounds grew more and more painful, but I knew that I was a lot better off than the boys on the boards. I watched the red ash of the cigarette die on the blackened floor, and I rose once more to walk the floor for another while, carpeting the floor with one of the blankets. "Bears in the yard!" came drifting across from one of the other blocks. It was really cold now, and the snow lay deeper in the yard and continued to fall steadily. I wondered what the torture mongers would be doing now. A would most likely be sitting drinking in the Screws Club in the camp with the rest of his mercenary friends and Brit soldiers. C and D would be at their houses with their families, and I wondered what they'd say if their children asked them, "What did you do today, Daddy?" Or better still, what would their wives and children say if they knew what they did and just how much suffering, grief, and torture they were causing and perpetrating upon hundreds of naked men? I paced onwards in my endless circle to nowhere. The lads were still talking and joking, one or two singing and humming to themselves. I was about to sit down once more on my mattress when the warning shout rang out, "Bears in the air, heavy gear!" I knew just what that meant. I dived at the mattress and put it standing lengthways in the farthest corner from the door, against the wall, and put the blankets behind it, wrapping the towel around my waist, forgetting the cold and securing the remains of my little tobacco parcel in my waist, banded the towel. I heard the first splash of lashing liquid at the cell facing me. Heavy gear, all right. I could smell it already. Ammonia-based detergent, a very strong and extremely dangerous disinfectant. The screws were lashing it under and through the splits in the sides of the door. I braved a quick glance through my little spy hole as the lights in the corridor were turned on. It was a very foolish and dangerous thing to do, because if the disinfectant hit me in the eyes, it would burn my eyes out, blind me in a matter of seconds. B was lashing a full bucket of the sickening liquid in under the door facing me and shouting to the other screws to hurry up and fetch more. I heard the chokes and coughs of the man across from me. The boys on the other side of the wing were in trouble. Their windows were blocked up. The fumes from the disinfectant were similar to tear gas. They cut at the eyes and throat, bringing on fits of vomiting and temporary blindness. I heard the hose being unraveled at the top of the wing. "Hose on the air," I yelled, and stepped back from the door. B was lashing the disinfectant in through the doors like a madman, laughing all the while. He had been wearing a small face mask that protected him from the fumes, and no doubt he and his companions were clad in their blue nylon overalls. The hose burst to life, and the thundering jets crashed through the bottom of the doors. I heard a swish and saw the greenish-colored liquid floating in under the door. Immediately, the terrible fumes struck me, and I began coughing and spluttering, and my eyes watering as I made my way to the window. My stomach was turning, and I thought I was going to be sick as I fought for gasps of air at the window, my head pressed tightly against the concrete bars. Every single man must have been at his window coughing. That's all I could hear, with the swish of the high-powered hose in the background. The tears were tripping me. I couldn't see a thing. Then the water came pouring in the sides of the door and came flooding across the blackened floor. I couldn't have cared less. I was shattered and coughing, my throat burning and dry. The water would dilute the disinfectant, I knew that, but it would be several minutes before the fumes cleared. The water from the hose was still streaming in under the door, and when it ceased, and then as the screw moved on to another cell, I was still coughing and spluttering, but the fumes were clearing. I could hear Sean vomiting violently. The whole wing was filled with moans and groans and coughing. B was literally screaming, "See how she was like that? See how she was like that?" Then he began singing the only song he knew, "The Sash." The screws turned off the hose. I braved it to the spy hole to see B plodding through the river of water, disinfectant, and urine with his face mask in one hand and an empty bucket in the other. He was laughing like a madman. The other screw came behind him, dragging the deflated hose, while the third screw hurled obscenities and abuse from the other end of the wing. My eyes were burning, but it wasn't too bad. The coughing still went on in the other cells. There was at least an inch of water on the floor. The end of my mattress was submerged in it, but the blankets were safely tucked in behind the mattress on the pipes. I began the long, exhausting job of scraping and pushing the ocean of liquid out under the door as best I could. "All right, Sean," I yelled. "No, I'm shattered," he answered. The coughing in the other cells died out to be replaced by the noise of scraping pose and as the drying up operation began. The stinking, putrefying rubbish was floating about around my feet and clogging whatever little gap there was at the bottom of my door. I had to keep clearing it with my hand, lifting handfuls of soggy bread, dirt, and filth and flinging them back into the corner. The water level began to subside. The fumes of the disinfectant still hung in the air, but they were mild. I glanced at the window. The snow was falling really heavy now, and the soft breeze was directing it in through the windows. Dear God, I thought, what next? My feet were numb and soaking, but my exhausted body was sweating as I continued to scrape and push the water out. When I had most of it out, I took the mattress and tried to squeeze the water out of the saturated part at the bottom of it. Then I tore a lump of it and began to soak up the remaining damp patches on the floor, leaving the soaking end of the mattress against the pipes in the hope that it would dry out. I took another peek out of my little spy hole and gazed at the river of urine and filth and everything else that lay like a lake outside in the wing. They'd be around in the middle of the night with the cleaning machine to clean and dry it all up. I threw the damp piece of foam into the corner and stood at the window to catch my breath. I was exhausted, but I couldn't stand too long on the freezing cold floor. The snowflakes were still coming in through the window. I had still only the towel wrapped around me, so I lifted the blankets and wrapped myself up again. The floor was still slimy and damp. I would have no alternative but to put the mattress down on it later, knowing that the dampness would seep up through the foam and attack my body. But it was either that or walk all night, which I wouldn't be able to do. It was going to be a long, freezing, cold, restless night. I listened to the boys describing their predicament out the windows. Several of the lads' mattresses were completely saturated. The blankets of others were in the same state. I wasn't too bad. At least it was only the lower end of the bed that was wet. All the noise had died, and mattresses and blankets were being dried as best they could. "Does anyone fancy a sing-song?" came the familiar question. After what had occurred, we had to do something to bolster our morale, and besides, everyone would be pacing the floor. A bit of a cheer went up, and the first singer was called to a roar of applause. I paced back and forth listening to the first singer singing "The Old Alarm Clock." The next singer was one of the Denny lads. He sang my old hometown on the foil. And after that, the singers came stepping up to their doors as they were called. Then came my call, and I braved it to the door to give my rendering of the Curragh of Kildare. And all the while as I sang, I was waiting for B to return and slip up unnoticed to lash a bucket of disinfectant into my face through the side of the door. I finished my song, being somewhat breathless, to a round of applause and went back to pacing as the next singer was called. My feet were numb. The floor had dried very little and was still slimy. I couldn't walk anymore, so I threw my mattress back to the ground and crouched up in the corner on the dry half of it. The bruises I had received in the wing shift and search outside the visits were hurting. I was tempted to roll another cigarette for myself and Sean, but I decided against it, as I knew I might well be able to. I might well be able to manage one blow between two down the line tomorrow night, and the way things were going, it would most likely be more than welcome then. The singing continued. It broke the monotony in the tension-filled air, and for a few minutes, helped take your mind off your surroundings and situation. There was no sign of B returning. Most likely he was lying on his back, around in the screw's mess, or else filling himself with more booze. Someone was singing a self-composed song about the blanket men, which was very good indeed. Then one of the lads began to sing Ashtown Road, The wing went deadly silent, and I sat, slightly shivering, listening to every note and word of the beautiful rendering of as the singer sang in his very sad voice. I felt my morale rising, and once again I was glad to be resisting. Better suffering while resisting than being tortured without fighting back at all. The singer finished, and the lads nearly tore the place down. The master of ceremonies called on the same singer to sing the last song, and away he went again with the wind that shakes the barley. The snow was still coming in the painless window, which reminded me of the night when we had to smash them with our bare hands when the screws lashed gallons of the heavy disinfectant in through the doors. The lads on the other side must have gotten it really bad tonight. I heard them cursing the blocked out windows when B had lashed the disinfectant through their doors. The singer finished the last song of the night, and everyone gave him a grand round of applause. A bit of chatter followed, and someone on the other wing was getting a message shouted over in Gaelic from the other wing, which was passed on to the OC. Some lad was very sick in the other wing. They rang the bell, and the screws turned the emergency bell off and ignored the sick man. Another lad's mother had died yesterday, and he had been refused parole like all the rest who had been in the same sorrowful position before him. I got to my feet and stood on the mattress, gazing at the window once more. The frost was thick on the wire, which sort of reminded me of the inside of a fridge. Some of the boys down below were saying goodnight to each other. Others were saying that they were going to try and walk as long as possible as their mattresses were soaking. Only a few remained talking at the windows. Sean knocked on the wall. "Och meh, Bobby," he shouted. "Och meh, Sean," I replied and added, "Is your mattress wet?" "No, it's not too bad," he replied. "I'm going to try and get warm under the blankets." "Meh who? Och meh, ocha," I said. "Och meh," he said, again, shouted again. The snow had stopped falling and only a soft breeze blew. The once smooth, untarnished surface of the snow was marred by the footprints of the screws. The white, puffy snow clouds had forsaken the sky, and the inky black sky returned, bearing a few stars that twinkled here and there. Most people would be in bed now, I thought. I wonder how they would feel if they had to wake up and to what lies in front of us tomorrow. Is it any wonder, I asked myself, that I've had several nightmares in the past few weeks, and every one of them connected with this hellhole? Dear God, where is it going to end? It's bad when you can't escape it through sleep, I thought. The noise had died completely in the other blocks, and those who had remained at the windows drifted away to either sleep or to stay up because of the state of their mattresses. It was very quiet. The snow glinted and glistened as the multicolored brilliant lights reflected on it. The silence was ugly and sinister. A curlew cried out in the darkness as it passed overhead. The spotlight of a hovering helicopter danced about in the black ocean of sky far out in the distance, and I wondered if my family were all right. They would be worried sick until another month's visit came around. It had been a hard day, but wasn't every day the same, and God only knew what tomorrow would bring. Who would be the unlucky unfortunates tomorrow, supplying the battered, bloody bodies for the punishment block? Who would be hosed down, beaten up, or torn apart during a wing shift? Tomorrow would only bring more pain and torture and suffering, boredom and fear, and God knows how many humiliations, inhumanities, and horrors. Darkness and intense cold, an empty stomach, and the four screaming walls of a filthy, nightmare-filled tomb to remind me of my plight. That's what lay ahead tomorrow for hundreds of naked Republican political prisoners of war. But just as sure as the morrow would be filled with torture, so would we carry on and remain unbroken. It was hard. It was very, very hard, I thought, lying down upon my damp mattress and pulling the blankets around me. But someday, victory would be ours, and never again would another Irish man or woman rot in an English hellhole. It was cold, so very cold. I rolled onto my side and placed my little treasured piece of tobacco under the mattress and felt the dampness clinging to my feet. That's another day nearer to victory, I thought, feeling very hungry. I was a skeleton compared to what I used to be, but it didn't matter. Nothing really mattered except remaining unbroken. I rolled over once again, the cold biting at me. They have nothing in their entire imperial arsenal to break the spirit of one single Republican political prisoner of war who refuses to be broken, I thought. And that was very true. They cannot and never will break our spirit. I rolled over again, freezing, and the snow came in through the window on top of my blankets. Chokyarla, I said to myself. Chokyarla.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me. In jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull me upon me. They're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleets me. Hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man thrives on hate.